it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleague and friend David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N. David is my co-pilot. We're headed to the moon thanks to our colleague of long-standing, Professor Chaim Ben-Arroya of Rutgers University, Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering. And Chaim's breakthrough, first out of the block book of many years past, recommend to everyone now because NASA's got new steps to the moon, to stay there, not to come back after footsteps or a golf cart. No, to stay there. And therefore, NASA will be needing and reading and debating Chaim's book, Building Habitats on the Moon, Engineering Approaches to Lunar Settlements. I recommend to everyone this book because it first pictures what it will be like when the settlements on the moon, the bases on the moon, whatever they're called eventually, have to shield human beings and also provide energy and exploration and science for people back on Earth. Professor, a very good evening to you. Once again, you were so far out front, it took Jared Isaacman, the new administrator, to catch up. And he did it. He's a spacewalker. He's a jet pilot. He's an astronaut. He's flown his own private missions on the Dragon capsule. And he says, we're going to the moon, and I believe him. But in order to go there, I learned from you over many years, there are challenges to mortal human beings. When you first heard that they're going back to the moon and they want a settlement there, what were your thoughts, Professor? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Great to be here. Very excited, hoping that this is finally the sequence of missions that will actually land people on the moon. Because as you know, every 10 years, new administrations come and go and plans keep changing. But I am hopeful. I think it's hopeful both that NASA is developing this rocket that seems to be working really well, but I think equally so that we have commercial companies that are also very successful building rockets and getting people at least into low Earth orbit so far. So I'm hopeful because of both the commercial and NASA's efforts.
David, you have a question for the professor.
Chaim, it's great to see you and great that we're starting the physical part of the process of getting back to the moon. And I don't want to see it somehow terminate down in the road. Can we do something to make this lunar mission permanent and keep the people jazzed up and enthusiastic about it so it doesn't terminate here and there or in a few years? How can we make this lunar mission different than what came before us?
I think that the challenge you point to is that these missions are not that frequent. And so one happens, people get excited, and then it goes away for a year or maybe 2 years. So I think the challenge is how to keep people involved in these missions. And NASA, SpaceX, the academic world has to really engage the everyday person, especially the younger people, somehow involve them in the activity, give them something to look at in between the big missions.
Your book, your several books on the subject of habitats, and it includes Mars. We're going to get there. It started with the moon, says NASA. Breaks down into categories that need to be challenged by engineering and science. There's the environmental risks. There's the structures themselves. What will the habitat look like? There are challenges to using local resources for manufacturing and defense and return to Earth. And then there's the human element that you call in your book, that's the psychological stress. I want to begin with a picture, and I want to begin with I know there are plenty of problems for us to talk about, but I'll begin with the habitat. You divide it into rigid structures, inflatable habitats, and lava tubes. Is there one more advanced than the other from NASA, or should we, or do we need to explore all three simultaneously?
It'll have to be sequential. The rigid structures are the simplest from the point of view of building them, bringing them to the lunar surface, and then having them essentially ready for astronaut habitation. The inflatables are more complicated. They offer advantages of large volumes, which is great for the astronauts, but more complicated to deploy, to maintain. The lava tubes, where I'm actually doing some research on now, are really long-term. We have these large volumes underground, open spaces that can be enclosed, pressurized, and then we can build cities in them, many cities, many buildings that can be more standard than the ones you would build on the surface. So being in the lava tube makes the temperature gradients much, much lower, more Earth-like, obviously shielding us from radiation, shielding us from micrometeorites. The challenge is that they're underground. We have to get into them and out of them. And some of the technologies still have to be developed. But they probably are the future of lunar cities. They'll be 90% underground.
David, you have a question.
We realize probably most of the early habitats are going to be on the surface. And we hear that the lunar regolith can insulate against radiation, but it's really toxic. So how do you cover a habitat with something that's toxic but also can protect against radiation? How do you make that safe?
That's one of the big challenges. Different ideas. The simplest is to just cover the habitat with regolith. The habitat itself would be self-contained and protected from the regolith. Then maybe cover the regolith with some fabric-like material so it doesn't float around. Other ideas are to put regolith into essentially large bags to contain them as well. Other ideas are to perhaps sinter the ground around the habitat, basically melt it so it becomes a solid, and then you don't have regolith flying around. Some combination of these would at least protect the habitat, at least to some level.
I want to go to what is called in your book in situ resource utilization, which has an acronym, amazingly, ISRU. You need to find quantities of moon, rock, dust, soil, regolith, and manufacture what? What can we hope for? What is there?
So the first thing would be perhaps to use 3D printing in situ resource utilization to actually build habitats out of the regolith. So that would prevent us from having to carry a lot of material from Earth, which is not sustainable over the long haul. The other thing is that the regolith on the moon has a bunch of materials that are actually quite valuable, oxygen, hydrogen, silicon, magnesium, among other elements. So if it can be processed, then we have some of the technology, some of the materials that we need for a technological base on the moon. The challenges are great, but there's a lot of research done on ISRU and using regolith.
And the reason I talk about the South Pole is they think there might be something there that can turn into liquid water, but there's no guarantee. Is that correct, Haim?
No guarantee, but they're fairly certain based on spectroscopic measurements of an impact of a spacecraft into the South Pole and other kinds of technologies. The challenge of the South Pole is that it's very rugged. From the bottom to the top, it could be about, I think, 5 kilometers. The challenge also is that a lot of it is in perpetual darkness. The sun would be on the horizon for most of the time. So there are challenges there, but they're hoping that if they can develop that, then they can have relatively large quantities of water that can be used for fuel, for oxygen, for other uses.
David, you have a question.
How do they plan to land in the rugged area of the South Pole? Do they need a big flat area, or can they land in a rugged area? What's the mechanics of landing?
So all the rockets we have need to have a relatively flat surface. I believe Apollo, when they landed on the surface, they needed a slope of no greater than 15 degrees, which is fairly flat. So that's one of the challenges. If they land at the top area where they're are more flat surfaces, they have a long haul to get down to the bottom where it's perpetually dark. If they land at the bottom, they really can't, they can't see anything for a lot of the time. So they're going to have a lot of challenges with that. And I really have a big question mark in my mind whether it makes sense to do that as a first mission. But who knows?
Let's go to the physical challenges. Ionized radiation and lunar dust. What's worse? Are they both bad? What happens?
So they're both bad. With radiation, we have a lot more knowledge about how to shield against radiation from our experiences on Earth. The challenge, though, is anytime the astronauts walk on the surface of the moon, they're being bombarded by radiation. So there are dose limits for the astronauts. Thus, the interest in using robots for construction and other activities. But electronics is also susceptible to radiation damage. So one way or the other, we have to shield against radiation, whether it's humans or robots. The dust is very dangerous, both again to humans and to machines. It's electrostatically charged. It gets displaced very easy. We saw the fogs around the feet of the Apollo astronauts. That was the regolith floating around. Low gravity plus electrostatic charging means that this dust can float around great distances. Also, with rockets landing and taking off, that could also project a lot of dust quite far. So dust protection technologies, whether using electrostatic charging, whether magnetic fields, other technologies, is going to have to be a big part of us being on the lunar surface.
David, you have a question.
If the dust is so bad and they're out excavating or doing whatever work they are, how do they prevent taking some of that dust in to the living quarters? Because they're in spacesuits and they obviously can't take their spacesuits off until they're in a safe environmental area where they can be without them. So how do you prevent dust contamination on the inside?
That's a real challenge. They weren't able to prevent that during Apollo. But since then, they've had some ideas on how to keep the dust on the outside. For example, I've seen where they actually had the spacesuits mounted on the outside of the of rovers. So they basically, when the astronauts go back into the habitat, they sort of back into these locations and climb out of the spacesuit, which basically is attached on the outside of the rover. So there's never any spacesuit coming into the habitat. And then there are technologies, whether magnetic, other kinds of technologies where the dust is gathered and collected in some room before they go actually into the habitat.
We're speaking with Professor Chaim Ben-Arroya, whose book, Building Habitats on the Moon, is a path forward for NASA and for the Chinese space program with its Roscosmos attachment, and for private enterprise on the moon. There are plenty of companies planning to land on the moon with robots. I understand they're not manned yet, but that is in the 21st century. When we come back, one more major concern: psychology of being in 1/6 gravity and darkness or bright sunlight for a long period of time. David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show, Hotel Mars Episode N. I'm John Batchelor.
Why is it always chaos when we link up? Because nobody plans anything, bro. Good thing the Rogue's ready like that.
For real. Rain, dirt, whatever. Available all-wheel drive, 5 modes, we still outside.
And they got some kick, too. That turbo? Torque is crazy. The most in its class. It moves.
Rogue doesn't mess around. And peep the space. Merch on merch, gear, mics, all of it fits.
Load up, we out. 2026 Nissan Rogue, built for all of it.
Auto Pacific segmentation, 2026 Rogue versus latest in-market competitors in the X SUV mainstream midsize class, excluding electrical vehicles based on manufacturer websites.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.